developers. And we have some informational items to start out the meeting with. We have a report from Jim Boyko on the rates, on Judge Lipscomb's decision, and on the board's decisions recently. And so we're going to just move through those. And if you have questions, feel free to ask those questions as we're moving through those. And then we're going to go on to public hearing on House Bill 2001. So Jim, come on forward.
Thank you, Chair Canopa, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Boyko. I'm the executive director of the Public Employees Retirement System. I'm accompanied by Christina Shearer. Your staff gave us a list of questions that we understand that you'd like us to address. So we will do so, and we will try to weave back and forth between the written text that you have and some graphical presentations to try to be as responsive as we can to your questions. And when we're done, we're certainly happy. We can field questions at any time, either after or during the presentation. The first topic that I'd like to respond to, the first question I'd like to respond to, is the status of the pending PERS employer rate increase. As of at the January 14th PERS board meeting, the board made a decision to reschedule final adoption of the employer rates until the next meeting. The board delayed this action for 30 days as a result of requests to forestall the beginning of the clock on that formal action would have started that would permit parties to file additional lawsuits against the board challenging those rates. We understand that such suits are quite possible and are widely discussed. We've even seen newspaper articles indicating that other public agencies have authorized joining such suits. However, at the same time, I'd like to stress that the rates that we have distributed to employers and have been presented to the board have not changed, and they remain scheduled to go into effect in July of this year. So I don't want the 30 days delay of the formality of adopting them to indicate that there's any change in the offering. We will be listening to employers throughout that period, but again, it would be misleading of me to suggest that we anticipated any changes.
Jim, is there a notification period that you guys have to provide, or could you just on June 30th, even though they're published rates, say, hey, these are your new rates, and mail them out?
I believe we've already mailed them out, Chair Canova, and
although they haven't become official, so is there anything else that needs to happen in that sequence, or could it happen at any time, I guess is my question.
I believe that nothing else needs to happen other than the board to formally adopt them and formally adopt the effective date.
Okay.
Just to summarize what those rates are, our actuary recently at the last meeting reissued a table to the board and to the agency indicating the order of magnitude of the rates system-wide that he was setting. This is not quite the same as the House Task Force on PERS saw, because what we're looking at here is the categories are a little bit different. We're looking at the effective rate increase for just state agencies alone, for the state judiciary, and for school districts. And keep in mind that some school districts now, school district rates vary now substantially, because some of them have done bonding and committed lump sum payments to us, so their rates might actually be a little lower individually. In fact, they can be unique rates now, below that 18.58% that I show. At the same time, what we're not showing you is the effect of the interest payment that they have to pay on those bonds, which is quite clearly an effective cost of providing pension coverage to their teachers.
And this is also without the pickup?
This is also without the pickup, that's correct. We always show rates without
the pickup. Two-thirds of all public entities in PERS have the 6% pickup?
My staff has told me that it's approximately 65%. So that's the update on the rate increase. Let me turn to the second question, which is the outlook for employer rates and the system UAL. As you recall, during the hearings convened by the various task forces before the beginning of the regular session, we were asked to do the intermediate outlook for both the unfunded liability and for rates, and I'd like to present an update of that using a model that had been created for us at our request by Milliman USA, our actuary. And the first thing I'd like to show is that the unfunded actuarial liability roughly stands about $14.3 billion. I believe this does not include a few hundred million in additional UAL that was associated with the Healthcare Retirement Trust. You can see that that the UAL has climbed, and what we're looking at here is what would happen to the UAL if it, in a linear fashion, somewhat unreasonable, but a very linear fashion, we earned exactly our assumed rate of 8% between now and the year 2007. And as you can see, that the UAL actually creeps up a little bit over this period. This is similar to a chart that I know, Chair Canope, you've seen in the past, and I think we've distributed to many members of the legislature. With respect to what rates are associated with this near-term outlook, they are largely driven by the UAL plus the what are called the normal costs of providing pension coverage. That is the cost that we would have to pay as public employers if there were no unfunded actuarial liability. So the combination of the UAL and the normal rate is combined to create an employer rate. And this table is consistent with the UAL table that you saw before. So we would anticipate, all else being equal, and we earn precisely 8%, no legislative changes, no assumptions about what would come out of the order that is being made final as we speak by Judge Lipscomb in his court, or any other initiative that's underway. This is the path of rates that our actuary would anticipate between now and 2007.
Mr. Chair, do you want us to wait for questions?
Representative Richardson, you can ask questions at any time.
Thank you. Mr. Botko, this assumes 8%. What is the actual return we've received in the last quarter, say the last 3 months?
Over the last 3 months, we had a modest positive return in the fourth quarter of last year. It's too early to tell, but as you know, Chair Canope and members of the committee, the fund over the last 3 years has not earned, nor has any public fund, to my knowledge, earned its actuarial assumptions, in our case, 8%. So I can't pinpoint exactly what the returns were over any very short period of time, but we could get back to you with precisely those answers because they are available.
Can you ask a couple of follow-up questions? Less than 2% for the last quarter?
On an annualized basis, maybe 2%, but quite possibly less.
Do you have any expectations at all that we will be maintaining 8%?
Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, our expectations for the long run, by the long run I mean 40 years, are that we'll earn 8%. It's what the actuary has recommended. It's what the board has accepted and adopted into the plan. So I would have to say that from the systems perspective, we expect 8%. Anytime, but that's a long-term average. In between now and 40 years, we can expect years in which we lose money, years in which we have outstanding returns. So for any shorter period of time, and that's one of the limitations of an analysis like this, we are only as good as the numbers that we pluck down, and that's why we're very reluctant to make specific 3 month, 6 month, 1 year forecasts. I think it's fair to say that the assumed rates for pension plans in both the private sector and the public sector are not going up. They're either staying the same or in a number of cases they're going down, and that's particularly true in the private sector. I know that's only partially responsive to your question, but it's the best I have right now.
Well, the reason I'm asking the question is these based on an assumption that is not within our immediate expectations, and so are there other charts that you have based on maybe a 4% return or a 2% return, or does that really have an effect over the next 3 to 4 years as far as what will have to be paid in?
Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, we do have some data we're about to show you, and in fact it has a substantial effect. So if we could move forward, perhaps.
You want 10 or 6?
Well, let's go to the next one, where I think the next one is 10%. Let's take, for example, the circumstance in which the next 5 years or so, we do not earn 8%, but in fact we earn substantially better than 8%. We earn 10%. You can see that rather than having a pretty much a flat edging up UAL, we have a UAL that starts to decline. And that would be good news if we can earn 10%. When I've shown this chart in the past, though, I've emphasized that this is a total return for a fund that is 35% composed large, on average of fixed income. So in general terms, this kind of performance would imply a stock market that rose at somewhat above 10%, probably in the 11, 12, or 13% per year consistently over this period, in order to produce 10% total returns for the fund. So this is what we would call the optimistic point of view above our expectations. In fairness, let's look at the more pessimistic view, and that is, what if we earn the same 2 percentage points but now below the actuarial assumed rate? You can see that the UAL climbs and climbs fairly rapidly over this period. And so in answer to your question, does the returns in the short run make a difference in the two measures that I know that people care a great deal about, which is the system's UAL and the rate, employer rate contribution levels that are necessary to point the system back toward full funding? And my answer is yes, they do. They have a powerful effect. I hope that is more responsive to your question. Are there any other questions, Chair Finope, on the employer rate outlook or the UAL outlook?
Looks pretty grim, actually.
Is what it is.
You're right.
If I could turn to another question that your staff indicated that you'd like us to address, and that is the status of the board's decision on actuarial equivalency factors and the mortality retiree longevity assumptions embedded in them. The board has made a decision. The newspapers are, for accounts of it, are somewhat confusing because, once again, the board has decided to make formal adoption of their decisions that they made this week on February 25th. But let me go back and give you a little bit of chronology. At the January 14th meeting a few days ago, the PERS board gave the PERS staff precise directions. They made decisions on how it wishes to implement the gradual transition to the use of modern mortality tables in the calculation of PERS benefits. All that remains at this point is to express those final decisions in a formally written administrative rule. The PERS staff is currently completing this rule, and we expect the PERS board to approve it no later than February 25th. This would be a special telephonic meeting that we would be holding in advance of the March meeting. The key points and the decision and the process that the board has adopted is somewhat complex, and we'll try to give you a snapshot of it today, but the key points of the board's policy and implementation process are as follows. First, to begin incorporating modern mortality tables in the agency's actuarial factors, that is the benefit setting factors, on 1/1/04. Second point is that from that point on, the PERS staff is to calculate the benefit using the new factors and tables and the member's balance at the time of retirement, post 1/1/04, but also calculate that, a benefit using the old factors and the old tables, and an account balance consisting of the member's 12/31/03 balance plus accumulated earnings, but not contributions, on that balance from that date forward to the end of the employee's career. I know that sounds complicated. I'll try to show how that works graphically in a moment. The member is to receive the monthly retirement allowance that is the highest produced by these two calculations. And I'm looking at my staff and hoping that I made sure that I got that right. So if I could turn to a couple graphs to try to indicate what I mean by that. Under money match, account values are combined with factors to produce monthly benefits. So under the board's implementation method, what would happen is that on 1/1/04, as you can see, the dividing line, date of change, prior to that, an account balance for this hypothetical member is growing. At that point, that member's balance, in essence, becomes a two-part balance, or we create two accounts for that member. The old balance, as of 12/31/03, continues on to grow, but doesn't get new contributions put in it, but does get earnings put into it. So that's what's happening in the red line, the pre-change account plus earnings, the red dotted line above. Below, a new account is created, we call it account prime for that member, and that account begins on 1/1/04 with the first contribution of that year, and then grows with all contributions post that period, plus earnings on that accumulating balance. So every member that we have, 190,000 or so, that are active, their single account, or their active account as of the 12/1/03, because they could have many accounts in their past history, will separate into two accounts that will then track each other and create the blue line above, which is the total account. So now we know, so this is, I know this is complicated, but this is the predicate on which the mortality tables then get applied to. So if we could move on to the next one. So now let's look at what happens to a hypothetical member like this with respect to what happens when that account structure is applied to various tables and then produces monthly benefits. Prior to 1104, a member is accruing an effective monthly retirement allowance using the old tables and the old balance. As of 1104, if we were to simply put in the new tables without any look back, the monthly allowance that those factors times that same balance would produce would be lowered, because we would be anticipating that the member would live the true expected lifespan that that mortality tables are indicating they will today. And so that's the red line below. What the board has decided to do, and that would be consistent, for example, with the notion of immediate and full implementation, the red dotted line below. What the board has decided to do is to go the green path, the green dotted line, and that is to say, use this look-back calculation back to 1231.03 that would say that the monthly retirement allowance will never decline from the point that would be produced at 1231.03 or subsequent to that as that account as of that time will continue to grow. So that benefit that is the look-back four actually creeps up over time, because remember, it's growing as earnings are fed to the 1231.03 account. At some point in the future, though, the contributions that are post 1104 that are being fed into the account prime, if you will, or the new account, the post-change account, get added to the total benefit. And at some point, when the total benefit is the total account balance, has the new actuarial factors with the modern tables embedded in them and applied to it, the account will have grown enough, the total account and account prime, such that the benefit that we need to pay will now exceed that look-back calculation. And that is why the green dotted line at some point in the future converges with the red dotted line, which is full reflection of modern mortality tables on the total account. And then from that point forward, the two are the same. And the issue is, and you might ask, well, how long is the period where the look-back floor, actually it's a rising floor, remains higher than the monthly retirement would be if we just did immediate implementation? And the answer is there are 190,000 separate answers, because it is unique to each member's account balance, their age, and their salary pattern and therefore contribution pattern in the post-104 time period. Now, if I haven't confused you, I'm amazed, because I've almost confused myself. It's complicated, but I want to stress that the board has a policy that they're pursuing here that I want to make clear. For a variety of reasons, regardless of the complexity, regardless of the complexity itself, the board is trying to pursue a simple concept, and that is to ensure that monthly benefits do not go down as a result of the change until post implementation events, in this particular sense, just contributions, are sufficient to raise the benefit above the old level, even when modern actuarial tables are applied to it. And I apologize for the complexity. I've often said there are no simple answers to questions when they involve PERS.
Jim, but if I understood you correctly, you indicated that the red line would be full and immediate.
That's correct.
But what you're saying, even though Judge Lipscomb's decision said that it needed to be full and immediate, what you're saying is the PERS board took a different tact.
I think that's a fair characterization, Chair Canope. But I want to stress that the board had a policy objective in mind. This was not willy-nilly.
Well, I hate to interject media reports into the the testimony, but in the Oregonian report, it indicates that when Steve Bashan from the AG's office, who's representing Peirce, asked the judge what immediately and fully meant, Lipscomb said it was up to the agency to decide, and then he said, do the right thing. I'm not in a position to tell you what that is. So I guess I just want to clarify for myself, if the red line is full and immediate, but Judge Lipscomb doesn't have an idea of what that is or doesn't want to dictate it, could the board come to the conclusion that really full and immediate is actually the green line?
It's possible, Chair Canope, that that's the case. The board has not formally responded to the judge's view.
Hold on, the chair's in trouble.
Cheers.
They're fine.
Does the chair need assistance?
Fortunately, I know how to turn off my phone. I just didn't do it in timely fashion. Okay, go ahead.
Chair Canope, the judge has been asked by the attorneys in open court several times what immediate has meant, and he has responded in various ways in saying immediate means immediate. But we all know, and I think the quotes indicate that, immediate is always tempered by pragmatic realities. But the assessment of pragmatic realities may differ depending on whose seat you sit in. Like I said, the board has charted a course and given the staff a direction, but it has not put that direction in the context of the judge's word or directive.
Okay. I assume that the board is acting on legal advice that they may have received from the Attorney General.
Chair Canope, the board during this lengthy period gotten advice from its actuary, from its staff, from the Department of Justice in executive session, and availed itself of a wide variety of opinion before reaching the tack that they're taking. I would say yes.
As it relates to the mortality tables, or about as it relates to other issues as well.
Some other issues as well, but particularly with respect to how it relates to the mortality table.
All those people have weighed in on the mortality table issue?
All of those people have been asked specific questions relating to it. I can't say specifically what's been provided in executive session, but it would not be fair to characterize that every advisor has been asked for their comprehensive views on the mortality table question. The staff has, and we appreciated the opportunity to have our say. In some cases, the experts have been asked highly specific questions related to sub-issues within the mortality table issue and the actuarial factor issue.
Does the PERS board have a policy that keeps that advice that they've received from those individuals private?
Chair Canope, members of the committee, I don't believe that there is a comprehensive umbrella policy on this that the board has. The board operates under state law, and you're beyond my expertise now. This is an area for either your attorneys or the Department of Justice to opine on as to the allowable instances in which the board can hold attorney-client discussions in confidence. As you know, we just discussed it, this is a subject of litigation, both current litigation and threatened litigation. So this would seem to fall within attorney-client communications and litigative strategy. But beyond that, in terms of the overall state policy about permissible holding of this kind of information and confidence, I'm not expert to testify.
I wouldn't argue with your interpretation, but it would be, I think, highly valuable to the legislature to understand why they've made the decisions they've made, and if we don't have full access to the advice that they've been given, I think that leaves us with lack of clarity. And so I would request that, to the degree possible, that the board release information that they've received as it relates to advice on these incredibly important issues.
Chair Canope, I can relay that to the board, they'll decide at their pleasure.
Thank you. I'm sure they're looking for input from me after all the things we've been through. But Representative McPherson, you looked very anxious to ask a question. I don't want to cut you off.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could, it's a follow-up to yours, and you already explored the issue, but I wanted to probe a little further, which is that you referred to the policy choice that the board made in designing this transition rule. Was it driven primarily by their decision on what they thought was good policy, or by the legal constraints that they were advised on?
Chair Canope, Representative McPherson, that's difficult for me to say because we have the board's vote and we have their discussion, the questions they've asked us and the answers we've provided. But you're almost asking for a weighing of factors, and without direct access to the board and their willingness to tell us, each one, as you know, may have a different weighing of the factors. I think it's fair to say that there certainly are legal constraints and opinions about where they lie. I think that I have no doubt that every member of our board wants to do the right thing. And the right thing is often in the policy area in the eye of the beholder. So, but as to the weight of one versus the other, I really can't respond. I apologize.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you very much, Chair Canope. And again, I apologize for the complexity. This is as quickly and simply as we could put it down in a short period of time. The second question, or the third question, really, that your staff has asked us to answer is to give you a status of the litigation before Judge Lipscomb. I just had a conversation with our attorneys, and my understanding is the order is being entered as final as we speak. The judge conducted a hearing earlier this week in which there was some interchange, and you referenced a media report about it with the attorneys moving toward a final judgment. There were a couple of events that I will simply mention to you that came out of that to give you a status update. One is that the executive branch of state government has retained separate private counsel who attended to represent the interests of the state as an employer. Beyond that fact, I can't report on the purposes or what the client, i.e. the state, has in mind with respect to that representation. The second thing is that we got no indication that the judge would materially change any of his findings that were the subject of the litigation, although until I get a chance to look at the final order that is being issued as we speak, we'll have to see if those indications were true. When we talked already about the full and immediate, the word immediate still stands alone in the report. And I do believe that the media report is, in a general sense, correct, that the board now has an opportunity to engage in what immediate might mean in the pragmatic sense of actually conducting a program. How the board will respond and when and in what manner, I can't say, because I don't know. Now all of the parties are in a position, and when I say all the parties, the interveners, the plaintiffs, the government agents, or the government entities that filed suit against PERS, and the PERS board itself are in the process of deciding whether or not to appeal those portions of the judge's order that they disagree with for one reason or another. And the board is in that process, but I have no announcements to convey to you about their intended course of action. So that's the update on that. And those are the questions that your staff asked. We have some contributions to offer with respect to comments on House Bill 2001, and we presume that if you wish to entertain those, you'll entertain those when you take up the draft bill.
Yeah, I have a few more questions as it relates to the Lipscomb decision. As it relates to your understanding of that decision, is that going to apply, for instance, the crediting issue or the mortality table issue? Is that just going to apply to the plaintiffs in the case, or is that going to be applied broadly to all PERS account holders?
Could I ask my staff a question before responding? I apologize, Chair Canova, members of the committee. The board has explored that question with its attorneys. Unfortunately, the exchange between the attorneys and the board on that question only occurred during executive session. So since that session material is owned by the board, I don't feel I can divulge it. The answer may be quite simple, but it's just a quirk of fate that I don't have a public record to rely on in responding to your question.
So I swung and missed again. Strike two, huh? Okay.
Yeah. Either that or you pitched a strike and I whiffed.
Other questions as it relates to the Lipscomb decision? Okay. Does that conclude your testimony?
It does indeed. Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay. If that's the case, we have the next issue up. And before we get to that, though, however, you have a few items in front of you. And you have, it looks like Kara has provided you all with the history analysis of PERS. I don't know if you all have this particular sheet. Have you all seen this before?
No.
You might want to kind of bring this to committee each time if you have questions as it relates to historical things as we go through this. This is a pretty good summation of what's happened to PERS over the last 50 plus years since it was instituted in 1946. And to make it easy for you, Kara, through the PERS agency, has provided you the booklet of the PERS statutes, which you will likely become much more familiar with. Chapter 238 is the biggest chapter as it relates to PERS, and there's roughly 100 pages of that, plus another chapter of ORS's related to deferred compensation and other issues. So that's before you. I put those news articles in your packet as well to make sure that you were aware of what was happening, or at least what's being reported as it relates to the Lipscomb decision and what the editorial community is thinking out there. And if there aren't any questions about those, we'll just move right on to the House bill that we have up and open a public hearing on House Bill 2001. And Dave Hendricks, if you will come up to start out with, I'd like you to take us through the bill a little bit before we have testimony. Of course, the additions that we're making will be in bold, and what we're taking out is going to be in italics.
That's correct. I'm hoping I can get a copy of the bill here quickly.
Oh.
Thank you. The House Bill 2001, Chair Knope, members of the committee, I'm Dave Hendricks of Legislative Council's office. House Bill 2001 would amend ORS 238-255, which you'll find in the PERS statute booklet you just received. 238-255 is what's commonly referred to in the press now as the 8% guarantee. If you look at it, what you'll find is that there is no reference to 8% anywhere in the statute, and that's because the guarantee is actually that the members that are subject to 238-255 will be paid what's called the assumed interest rate. You'll also look long and hard through the booklet of the PERS statutes to find out what the assumed interest rate is, because there's nowhere in the statutes that you're told that either. This law, 238-255, was passed in 1975, which you should find on your chart if you look on there, and basically was designed at that point to make some minimum guarantee to how much would be credited to the accounts of members in any given year, and the phrase they used was to say that the members that were subject to this would receive at least the assumed interest rate. The assumed interest rate is a number that was in existence and has been in existence. If you look at the chart, you'll actually see the history of that number as it went through the years, starting out at a very, very low amount and gradually building up to the 8% that it's now at. And in the first part, in the first, oh, up until about 1970, I don't have the chart in front of me, it may actually show in there. For a long, long time, PERS was prohibited from investing in stocks. In fact, most state funds in the Treasury, you can't invest in stocks. It's prohibited. But PERS had a special exemption, and that was a constitutional, there was a constitutional reason for that. In about the 1970s, the Attorney General rendered an opinion in which he said, well, that constitutional provision really doesn't apply to PERS monies because it isn't really money of the state. It's money that's held in trust for the employees, so we don't need to worry about the constitutional prohibition on investing state monies in stocks. You can invest it if you want. And they passed a law that allowed them to put up to 50% of the PERS funds into stocks. And that caused a big jump right there in the assumed interest rate, because the assumed interest rate was driven by how one definition of what the assumed interest rate is, what the PERS actuary thinks the fund is going to earn over a 40-year period, in any given 40-year period, what they think the fund is going to earn. And that is driven to a large degree by the types of investments that are made with the PERS funds. When they made the jump to allow them to invest in stocks, there was a jump in the assumed interest rate because the actuary said, well, if you're going to go into those types of investments, we know you're not going to be locked in at those rates you get off of bonds, which at that time were fairly low, and we can say overall we think that because of the stock market investment you'll earn more, took a jump up. But nevertheless, in 75, looking back at the legislative history of this statute, there was concern because there was a stretch of years during that period back in the early 70s when the accounts of the members weren't earning much at all, or at least wasn't earning very much, and they put into effect this law that said, well, we'll credit you with at least the assumed interest rate, this rate that's set for other purposes, but we'll let you use it and say you're going to earn at least that much. I don't know, if in looking back over the years and looking at the statutes, and I've been looking at it now for 13, 14 years, originally I thought this was originally probably intended to be something of a leveling device, something to say that, say you've been working for many, many years and you're getting towards the end of your career and the fund suddenly has a string of bad years. And I think the argument that was probably made back in 1975 is, look, if you're assuming that overall we're going to earn X percent, why not even it out by saying we'll give you at least that assumed rate on the assumption that we'll make it up later on. Make it up later on. And they clearly contemplated that that they might have a bad stretch of years. I mean, both in the language of the statute and in the discussion of this particular measure at the time it was presented to the Legislative Assembly. And at one point we'll be looking at a bill that talks about what's commonly now coming to be referred to as the call, which is one sentence that appears in this statute. It says you can only maintain a deficit account for the purposes of this guarantee for 5 years. That's not my topic today. But sub 2, if you look at the bill, what we're doing in sub 2 is basically saying that for the purposes of those people who are subject to this section, I need to explain here, I don't know, some of you probably have been to some of the presentations about the system generally, but just as a refresher, the guarantee that you get paid, the assumed rate, in 1996 they passed what's commonly referred to as the second tier, and you'll notice that the measure summary of this bill talks about tier 1 members versus tier 2. The guarantee of the assumed rate only applies to people who became members of the system before 1996. Anybody who's become a member of the system since 1996 doesn't have this guarantee. So a lot of the problems we're looking at here, they're certainly serious, as you can see from the numbers on the chart, but hopefully in 20 or 30 years, when we get the last people out of the system who are higher, who became members before 1996, the assumed interest rate is no longer a problem because it just doesn't apply to anybody who comes in after 1996. So we're talking about the accounts of people who established membership in the system before January of 1996, that for the purposes of this thing, what we say in very succinct language in subsection 2 is it's not only the guarantee of 8%, but that's also a cap. That anything above 8% from here on out basically goes to either reduce the deficit that we currently have or to fund the reserve that they need to pay the 8%. And if anything goes beyond that, it says it goes to the employer. So that's what the bill does.
Now, I've asked you to draft some language to look at line 23 to modify that, to change employers. And we were looking at language. Were you able to accomplish that amendment yet, or are you still working on that?
Chair Knope, I started working on it. As you know, Jim Boyko, the director of PERS, was going to be talking with the actuary because he's a key piece of this particular question as far as what the actuary's reaction is to whatever we draft as far as what goes into this bill. And I believe that Jim has some things he can add on this here with respect to the specific language and the change as far as what now appears in the bill as opposed to some other possibilities.
So if anybody has concerns about line 23, there is language being drafted that would clarify that it's not necessarily going to go to just to employer accounts, but that it's going to go to reduce the unfunded liability until it's completely gone. And anyway, we're trying to come up with the right language that will trigger the actuary's I guess solidifying his projections based on 8% as opposed to 8.5%, which is my understanding of what he currently does as it relates to the how he figures the unfunded liability.
Chair Knope, let's see if I can, maybe Jim can do a better job of this. He can chime in. Maybe I can do a layman's sort of reaction to it as I'd understand it. The actuary, in looking at what has to be credited to the Tier 1 member accounts, and mind you, even though we're only talking about people hired before 1996, we're talking about the great majority of PERS members and the huge majority of the money in the fund right now, because those people have got big accounts and the new people coming in have got small accounts. So we're really talking about a huge proportion of the member accounts in the fund. When the actuary looks at that and makes projections about how much money is going to be put into those accounts, the actuary is not assuming 8%, because the statute as it's currently written doesn't say you only get 8%. It says you get at least 8%. And historically, as you know from the newspaper stories and in the case in Marion County, in those good years, there were amounts far beyond 8% credited to the accounts of members, as much as I think it was 20% in 1999 to Tier 1 member accounts, regular accounts. So when the actuary looking at that hasn't assumed that 8% is what's going to be credited, he has assumed 8.5% based on historical analysis, I presume, of what has been done in the past. That means that there's a half a point of earnings on these accounts that he has been assuming will go to the members and will not be available for other uses, i.e. towards obligations and liabilities of the employer. Part of what we're looking at here as far as an immediate impact with respect to employer contributions is if that 5%, 0.5% is no longer credited to employee accounts, if the actuary doesn't assume that, to assume that there's going to be an extra 0.5, that becomes available for other liabilities and reduces employer contributions. And maybe it's a good time for Jim, because I know they have some numbers on this now as well.
Thank you. Any questions of our legal beagle before we send him back to the cheap seats? Yes. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have, and you may have addressed it in the amendment you requested to be drafted, but I want to make sure. As I read this, not as a legal expert, the language in Section 2 allowed had these surplus earnings over 8% to go to fill up the gap of the deficit, the unfunded liability. And then once you bring that up to zero, then all surplus earnings in the future go to some group, either the employers or not. The question I have for you is, do we recognize the existing policy of maintaining a 30-month reserve, and would only surplus earnings after you've satisfied that 30-month reserve go to what accrediting, or would it, would this bill prevent the board from maintaining a fiscally responsible reserve of 30 months or whatever the right amount is, but it would it preclude maintaining a reserve?
Representative Knope, Representative Nolan, the bill does contemplate, the draft as drafted, it does contemplate that the reserve that is established in the 238-255 also have a reserve built up in it. The language specifically indicates that after you pay off the reserve account until it no longer, you have to pay it into the reserve account until it no longer has a deficit and is fully funded. So whatever level of funding they establish for that reserve, and I should maybe try to help in case, I don't know how much of this is new to some of the members about the reserves. The board has always had a policy with respect to having a reserve to pay this guaranteed amount, to have money set aside out of earnings in prior years so that when the bad years come, they would have some money set aside to help pay for this. And that came out of earnings on both employers and employees' accounts. It came from both sources. It's gone through some changes over the years, and Jim or Steve could tell you, at one point it was 18 months for a short period, and the theory was, is how much should we set aside in the one they currently have was a policy of funding a reserve that would have enough money in it to pay the 8% guarantee for a period of 30 months in which the fund had no earnings. Not a loss, but as though the fund had a 30-month period of zero earnings, they would have enough money set aside to continue to pay this without creating a deficit account to hold the losing numbers. Well, that was a fairly new figure, the 30 months. They never did fully fund it. The monies that were in the reserves were wiped out in the first year of losses on the fund, and we went into a deficit the first year. The second year of losses were just all losses, and there was no money to go after it. So the answer, I guess that's a long answer to a short question. The answer is this does contemplate that first you pay off the deficit, then you fund the reserve, and then after that it goes to the employers.
But it doesn't specify what that policy ought to be.
Right.
It just sort of ratifies or just allows whatever policy they have in terms of fully funding the reserve to be there. Other questions? And since you're going to be appearing before us quite a bit, do you prefer David or Dave?
I actually don't have a preference.
And you keep telling me that, and one of these days I'm going to get it.
You can call it right. Call me Dave. Dave's fine.
Dave is fine. All right. Thank you. Jim Voico, if you could come up and give us some testimony on this bill and your thoughts as it relates to what we're doing here and how it might affect the ability to administer the fund and accomplish what we need to, I think, which is some reforms.
Well, thank you once again, Chair Knope and members of the committee. Once again, for the record, I'm Jim Voitko, the Director of PERS. Your staff asked us to present some comments on House Bill 2001, and we offer these comments, but I want to say at the beginning, and I know you tire of hearing me say this, but because this legislation potentially affects benefits, it's a policy matter that neither the PERS staff nor me nor the board wishes to either promote or discourage. We believe that areas and matters involving benefit levels are reserved for the legislature to decide, not for us. So the comments that I'm about to provide you don't reflect any policy preferences of mine or my staff or the board's, but just our technical understanding and our best understanding of the objectives of the draft bill as the words indicate. First, some factual background. As David said, in estimating the portion of the system's liabilities that are associated with Tier 1 member benefits, currently by far the largest percentage of those liabilities, we are a Tier 1 system at present, our actuary assumes that there are accounts, and remember we showed before that accounts drive our times factors, create benefits, that the account value growth determines the level of those liabilities. Because in the past, and the structure of the plan, says that the worst that a Tier 1 member could get is 8%, or the assumed rate. Let's call it 8% because that's what it is now. But they could get more. Our actuary can't simply put 8% in as the assumption, because merely the possibility that they could get more, plus the historical experience of more, which, and in some cases substantially more, prudence dictates that he has to put in something more than 8%. He has used 5%. Now, obviously, this exceeds our estimate of the fund's investment rate of return, which currently stands at 8%. So that when tier members retire, we have since 1989 been taking their accounts, translating them into a stream of benefit payments that assumed continued growth in the assets funding them of 8%, and then added a 2% COLA as well as required by statute. This in part reflects why the projected UAL that I showed you earlier under 8% actually creeps up a little bit over time. This is part of a number of factors that indicate to us that earning exactly 8% isn't quite enough. We've got to earn a little bit more. Now, turning specifically to HB 2001, the apparent policy thrust, as we best understand it, is to seek a balance between crediting earnings to Tier 1 member accounts and creating benefit obligations versus, on one hand, versus the financial health and sustainability of the pension system on the other. As we read the draft bill, it seems to envision pursuing that balance by either removing or possibly tightly constraining the possibility of crediting more than 8%, and removing the possibility of crediting Tier 1 earnings in excess of the assumed rate from this date forward would allow our actuary, as David described to you, to assume that it's 8%. It's not 8.5% to accommodate the possibility of higher creditings. This would have a derivative effect of lowering our expected pension liabilities. It would lower the expected benefits that we would have to pay, and as a inevitable result, it would also lower the expected rate increase that we would that we are planning to put in place that I discussed earlier on July of this year. And I had a discussion and have a response back from our actuary that the effect of a firm cap that is never more than 8% would lower that rate increase by about 1.5 percentage points, or approximately $100 million in public employer contributions statewide. One of the other things which I stressed in the task force hearings that Chair Knope held was that this is one of the few changes that have been bandied about in the current system that would actually take effect right away. Because as soon as the actuary looks out and can no longer has to account for the extra 5%, that, unlike some other changes that have been considered in the current system, can be reflected in rates right away. And I know that that has budgetary implications that are of interest to you.
Jim, on that $100 million, I'm looking at this sheet. Did you say annually? $100 million annually?
I believe that is correct. I got it about 20 minutes before we were able to come down here, but I believe it's annually.
And Mr. Chair, is that for state, and the local employers?
Yes, this would be system-wide. So the states, because the state is by far the largest employer, the state would garner the largest bulk of that, school districts as well.
And did you tell us what how much it would decrease the unfunded liability?
I don't have that number right at hand, but I believe it's in the letter. If you look at the value of unfunded liability, it would reduce it by about $900 million, or just under $1 billion.
So just this one bill would have the effect of lowering the unfunded liability $1 billion if it was a hard 8% cap. And it is Mark Johnson going to come testify that he believes that this bill is essentially a pretty hard cap
We communicated with him, and as I had said previously, the actuary needs a formal, definitive change in the plan structure in order to make a change in actuarial assumptions. Otherwise, correct, he's acting outside the statutory directive. And I have described this to him, and he has verbally told me that this sounds pretty hard, this sounds pretty definitive, and it would come in place sooner rather than later. So all the things I represented to you previously appear to be true, but he is prepared to come and reiterate those things to you personally.
So after looking at the amendments, he'd be able to give us that direction from his vantage point, how he views this particular bill?
Indeed.
Okay. But as for now, he's saying that saves $100 million in statewide costs as it relates to PERS annually, and it would essentially take about $1 billion off the unfunded liability.
That's correct. With your permission, I'd like to alert the committee to a few other implications that occurred to us as we read this bill, and particularly relating to the difference between a draft bill that's constructed like HB 2001, which is, as you referred to it, Chairman Knopf, a hard cap, versus one that simply mandates the, and this would mandate the elimination, in a hard sense, the potential for crediting above 8% from this point forward, versus a concept that would tightly constrain the opportunities for above 8%. And I will explain why you might wish to consider this, obviously your decision, but you might wish to consider that approach alongside this one and decide which one meets your objectives. Obviously, the statute as it has been executed to date has resulted in Tier 1 member crediting in excess of the assumed rate on multiple occasions. And curiously, as you look back over history, in most, if not all of those occasions, and I believe it's all, the system was actually in actuarial deficit when crediting took place above the assumed rate, above 8% or whatever the assumed rate was at the time. So one of the things that occurred to us that we would offer to you is that you could constrain the opportunity to get above 8% to some measure or metric of health of the pension's financial structure itself. For example, you might consider limiting the possibility for Tier 1 crediting in excess of the assumed rate only to those periods when the pension plan is either fully funded, 100%, or in surplus. A financial state of affairs that is not something that is an extra standard that you would be bringing in to the plan structure, it's actually already in the plan structure. We are directed by statute to pursue full funding at all times, to be actuarially sound. So what you would be doing is saying that the mandate for actuarial soundness, in essence, has precedence over other aspects of the statute, particularly the opportunity, the exercise of the opportunity to receive earnings credited in excess of the base guarantee. So constraining the occasions for crediting excess earnings to Tier 1 members to only those circumstances when the system's financial health demonstrably meets or exceeds the existing statutory mandate might well achieve the same balance that HB 2001 appears to pursue, and yet at the same time keep alive the opportunity for Tier 1 members to get greater than 8%. And I'm not suggesting that that should be your policy objective. But what's interesting is that if the standard or the prerequisite that has to be met is high enough, two things happen. One is that its financial effects become very, very close to a hard cap without being a statutory hard cap. For example, you saw the unfunded liability projection over the next 5 years, and I know Chair Canope and a few others have seen the simulation presentation, which shows that the unfunded actuarial liability, all else equal, will continue on perhaps for as much as the next 20 to 25 years. If that's the case, and if that's the prerequisite that has to be met before you credit above 8%, then it will have precisely the same financial effects as a statutory hard cap. The only benefit that I can propose for such an alternative approach is that I think it is likely that if you remove altogether the possibility of
gaining access to excess earnings, then people, some members may make claims that this possibility in and of itself is a contract right. By keeping the possibility alive, that eliminates or makes it difficult to make that claim, and particularly because you've constrained the opportunity by some other legitimate measure of financial happiness. So I offer that for your consideration, but I'm not here to sell it. I have a few other comments that occurred because of Representative Nolan's question that I would like to offer as well, and that is, there, despite the language of the statute, no trust fund money goes to employers, period, end of story. Once lawful contributions have come into the trust fund, it's a one-way street. We do not send money back to employers. We do adjust future contributions based on the contributions that have been made, and we do so over our amortization period, which is 26 years, but we don't send money back that is the appropriate contribution level. The one of the things that has concerned me a little bit about the bill is any indication that would inadvertently create a new crediting sequence that overlays one the many of them that are already in the statute. And one of the things that I'd like to pursue and confirm back in writing to the committee is whether or not the existing statutory crediting in fact accomplishes exactly the aim without using the employer language. For example, if we have earnings above 8% and we give Tier 1 8%, and we give Tier 2 what the fund earns, which is what statutorily they're supposed to get, and get regardless. If we give variable what the variable investments in the fund get, which is what they're supposed to get by statute, then the only remaining places that the rest of the earnings can be credited, if there's an effective cap or a hard cap, is to the benefits in force reserve or what's called the employer's accounts. And the employer's accounts are merely trust funds that we hold for beneficiaries that we happen to use on behalf of the employer to match members' dollars or to fund anything else in the fund that requires funding that is a responsibility of the employer. So I don't think that, if you stick with the current statutory crediting, you don't risk inadvertently creating some new statutory indication about how earnings should be credited. It does allow exactly what Representative Nolan asked about, and that is that the board to exercise its ability to fund with excess earnings either the gain-loss reserve or the remaining accounts. And I have even more confidence of that if you leave the current statutory crediting in place. And I want to make one correction. The board does have from the legislature guidance as to not specifically how big a gain-loss reserve it should have in numerical terms, but Senate Bill 134 that was passed in the last regular session instructs the board and the staff to set up a reserve that is of sufficient size to avoid the creation of Tier 1 deficits. So we do have some general policy direction, which we now have tools in place to implement that we never had, that the board never had before. I'm talking about analytical tools and projection models. So with that, I'll stop, and I appreciate the patience with which you have borne my comments.
Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
Like to, Jim, I have a question about the experience that other systems may have with an earnings guarantee and whether there's a corresponding cap. Is there any counterpart in either public or private pension plans that we could draw experience from?
Chair Canope, Representative McPherson, we have looked, and I can't say our survey has been anything comprehensive, but we have surveyed trade associations and we have looked at the websites of other plans and we've visited other plans and contacted other plans. There are very few plans that work on the basis of a financial guarantee, very few public plans. There are a handful that do. There are none that I'm aware of that grant as the financial embedded guarantee the full assumed earnings of the fund as the guarantee. I think we're aware of one that guarantees a financial return, but it is at a substantial discount. It's kind of a protective floor, but below what the full expectation that the fund will earn. And I believe, and I'm speaking from memory here only, that it's at least a 20% discount. from what the expectations of the fund's earnings will be. The other difference is that I've not run across any public fund yet that grants that guarantee on an annual basis as opposed to on an over a career basis, as David would refer to it as a kind of smoothing at the end of a career. Ours is unusual in the sense that the guarantee is executed each and every year. And that has consequences because it makes the generation of benefits under Money Match extremely sensitive to year-to-year volatility in investment returns in the capital markets. That makes our plan unusual. That's the best response I can give you, Representative McPherson.
Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Voitkol, you indicated that the assumed interest rate is basically calculated by the actuary. Since 1946, it's gone up six times. It's never gone down. If it's at 8% or 8.5% based on the way things looked in the year 1989 or in the 90s, then would not a renewed calculation at this time adjust that 8.5% down?
Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, that calculation is refreshed at a minimum of every 2 years when, by statute, we do a plan valuation. And the process goes as follows. The actuary takes the old assumption and asks and does it from like a zero-based budgeting concept up. He consults the investment consultants and advisors to the Oregon Investment Council and finds out their thinking. He goes to his internal investment advisors within his actuarial firm and gets their assessment. And then he comes back to us and discusses the various factors and the points of view. And the points of view, I'll be honest with you, in the profession differ probably more today than they have some, at some periods in the past. And the actuary either decides to re-recommend the old number, the existing assumed rate, or change it. So that's the process, and that process was just gone through this last fall. He recommends it to the board, and the board either accepts it or rejects it. And the board accepted the continuation of the 8%. It was recommended by the actuary. So I will say that some of the rise that you see, particularly from the early 1970s through the mid to late 80s, is a result of the changing composition of the investments that we use. As David Hendricks said, we shifted from lower return, lower volatility bonds to higher volatility but much higher return investments when we added equity to the portfolio. This is a process that almost all pension plans, foundation plans, public plans, private plans alike have gone through. And so there's nothing unusual about that. And that accounts for much of the increase. There's some structural change that goes on. The other thing that the actuary has to look at is precisely how the Oregon Investment Council is investing the funds. That is primary. For example, let's do a thought experiment. If the Oregon Investment Council took all of the funds and said that they believed it was prudent to put them all in 10-year bonds, which currently yield about 4.11%, then the actuary would have no choice but to come back to the PERS board and say, I believe the long-term rate of return is not 8%, but it's something far lower. So the primary driver of the assumed rate is not really expectations about the future, it's expectations about the future plus the investment strategy of the Oregon Investment Council.
May I follow up?
Follow up.
How is this actuary selected?
The actuarial contract to be the systems actuary is put out for bid periodically, and I think, in fact, a renewal is on the horizon. We go through the standard RFP process for professional services. We look for bids. I believe I'm speaking from memory now that we got five bids the last time. And the board opted to choose again to stay with Milliman, who has been our actuary since, I believe, the mid to late 1970s.
Any other questions from the committee? I have a couple, Jim. I just want to clarify in my own mind. You spoke about, obviously, what you called, I think, the effective cap. And this bill, as written, would be more of a hard cap. And was it your testimony that it was your understanding that the actuary would see an effective cap very similarly as a hard cap?
I have had that discussion with him, more specifically asking the question, Chair Canope, if the prerequisite that had to be met was full funding or surplus for the plan as a whole, then the logic would be, if the actuary believes that the amortization period is the period during which we would reach full funding, and that is our assumption. We set rates not to get fully funded next year or the next biennium, but to get fully funded over a period of 26 years, then he would have his own assumptions would lead him to the logic that says there's no 8% possible during unfunded liability periods, and I'm projecting 26 years of unfunded liability to exist. So we've had that conversation, and he can appear before you and confirm whether or not what he told me was right. But that would make it a hard cap or a close to hard cap, absent sunshine raining on us from the investment markets, for the amortization period. That may or may not suit the policy objectives of the drafters of the bill, and I don't pretend to. It's merely the best facts I can give you to consider at this time.
And my other question relates to possible litigation. I guess I have two questions. One is it relates to this bill, and one is it relates to the Lipscomb decision, which I forgot to ask you earlier, and I apologize. Has the board taken a position either in favor or against kicking that, or expediting might be a more accurate term, expediting the Lipscomb decision to the Supreme Court, thereby cutting the possible time frame for a decision on that particular case? And as it relates to this bill, if this bill were, somebody were to sue based on the language in it, and we weren't in session and weren't able to deal with it, has the board taken a position as it relates to expediting future legislation to the Supreme Court? Or do they have they voiced a problem with that?
Chair Canope and members of the committee, the board has not taken a position on expediting any of the board's decisions or any legislative actions to the Supreme Court, and I, looking through their goals and objectives, I'm unsure as to whether or not they would. And the reason I'm unsure is it's not a benefit issue, so conceivably they might speak to it. It's a process issue, but there's nothing in the goals and objectives that suggests that they do believe it's part of our purview. With respect to expediting the mortality table decision, the board has no way to influence the expediting, because the legislature has spoken on that issue by passing a bill and saying it will happen. So it will happen. However, the board can influence when the process kicks off by either accelerating or delaying when they actually make their decision, because your expediting directive cannot take effect until the board takes an action. I can say that the board, as I testified earlier, has decided to have an earlier telephonic meeting, February 25th, rather than their normal March meeting, in order to move the process along. So I think that I can only infer from that the board is acting in a way to try to quicken the pace for judicial review as opposed to slow it down.
Okay. Other questions for Jim? Representative Richardson.
I'd like to proceed with just a couple more questions about the actuary. The unfunded actuarial liability is set at $14.3 billion at this time, right?
Plus about $500 million or so associated with the retiree health plan. We were looking at just the pension plan. Recall that we also have a trust fund that we operate to fund the subsidy provided for health insurance for retirees for our system. And so that also is an actuarial deficit.
And your projection is it'll take about 26 years, is that correct, to get us back in the black?
Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, that's a choice that we make. It's just like any other debt that you have. You can choose whether to pay it off in 5 years, 15 years, 20 years, or 30 years. The board has an amortization schedule that used to be 30 years, and in some cases longer. Following an actuarial audit that we conducted a few years ago, the board opted to go to a more conservative 20-year amortization period, but to do so a year at a time. We are now partway through that process, and that's why I mentioned that we're at 26 years. Next year, we'll be amortizing UALs, new UALs, at 25 years. 24 until we get to 20, which is the amortization period that the board felt was prudent. Public plans in general pay off their obligations over a much longer period of time. ERISA, I believe, requires private plans to do so in 5 years, so they're on much shorter amortization schedules.
The 8% has been in place since 1989. Is that every 2 years? You said that the actuary comes forward, and so that's been the recommendation for the last 13 years or 12 years?
That's my best understanding.
Okay. And so last year when the actuary said it should stay at 8%, that was the same percentage that he came up with in 1998, in the year 2000, and he made that recommendation at a time when we got $14 billion plus in the hole and it's going to take over 20 years to pay it back. Could you tell us, did he justify how he could retain that same 8% in this market and with those projections, with this deficit?
Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, he did present a justification and in detail in terms of showing the composition of that anticipated return. And I have seen a number of other ones as well from people like Frank Russell, who advises the Oregon Investment Council, as well as other investment advisors whose seminars I've attended. So the process is well understood. It's just that people have different views of the future. But I do want to clarify that when the actuary, say for example, let's go back to 1989, estimates 8% and recommends it as the 40-year average return, there should be no expectation that the next year's return or even the next 5 years' return will be 8%. It could be 2, it could be 10. In some respects, for better or worse, you don't know whether or not the 1989 projection is accurate until 2030. And that's one of the conundrums of the world of pensions, unfortunately.
Well, one follow-up. Then actually the 8% that he proposed in 1998 may have been grossly low, because if he's saying last year with a $14 billion deficit, he's still projecting 8% for 40 years. You have to make up the deficit because of compounding. You're compounding on a less amount of principal. Certainly there would be a different environment and a different amount of annual rate of recovery that would be required with a fully funded 1998 plan and a $14 billion short plan is currently, right?
Well, Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, I may have, perhaps I misled you interjecting a variable that doesn't belong in the accuracy of the estimation of the assumed rate. Three things I'd say. First, in 1989, in hindsight, the estimate of 8%, at least as looking at the reality that emerged from 1990 through 1999, was excessively low. But as I said before, that's not the measure of whether or not it was good or bad. At least during that period, it looked like it was low. But it's not meant for just that period. The estimate of 1998 of 8% looks like it was grossly high when you look at the reality of 2000, 2001, and 2002. Does that mean it was bad or not? It's way too early to tell. Unfortunately, again, that's one of the conundrums. But one thing that I will stress is the estimation of the assumed rate is independent of the financial situation or report card of the fund or the system at the time it's made. Because the assumed rate only asks the question, if whether you have $1 or $100 billion, what's the rate of return that you can expect on that asset pool, regardless of how big it is or how well or poorly it compares against your liabilities for the next 40 years? What is it going to earn, not is it the right size? So the actuary unfunded liability plays no role in the estimation of the assumed rate.
Or the size of the principal.
Or the size of the principal, precisely. Your rate of return on what presumably is a very large portfolio is the same estimation of what it would be for mine.
Thank you. Other questions? Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
I think I'm going to call up panels. Jim Green, Hasina Squires, Maria Keltner, and Michelle Deister. And then we'll call up...
Vita.
On deck would be Anthony Vita, Brian DeLashmet, and Tricia Smith. And if you didn't hear your name called, you haven't signed up yet, or at least we don't have a record of it. So if you do want to testify, let us know.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association here today representing PERS Employer Coalition that contains the Association of Oregon Counties, the League of Oregon Cities, Oregon School Boards, and Special Districts Association. Mr. Chair, you'll remember during the task force, we testified to six ideas that we thought could help right now, help employers with the cost and the taxpayers with the cost of the PERS system. Included in the testimony that's being put in front of you are those six ideas. And first at the top of the list was this idea that's found in House Bill 2001. We fully support the idea of making that a cap, a ceiling, if you want to call it that. Right now, the assumed earnings rate is floor. We believe that putting it as a ceiling until such time as that deficit account is retired is prudent. That deficit account is one that was established in statute. PERS Board is only allowed to carry it for 5 years. That's what we referred to in the call a little bit later on in our testimony. But we believe that until such time as that account is taken care of and the system is actuarially sound and funded, that the 8% should also be the maximum guarantee that those Tier 1 members should receive. And we'd be happy to answer any questions. The testimony that you have is exactly the testimony we gave before your task force, and believe that this is prudent policy for the board to adopt, for this legislature to tell the board to adopt. They have it as a policy right now. And we'd like to see it in statute so that it's a guaranteed lock in there so that we can get that deficit wiped out prior to paying anything above the 8%.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, that took all four of you. That's impressive.
You said to be quick.
Come on up.
Representative Kenopin, members of the committee, old friends and new friends, in case you're not aware of all the clients that I represent have an interest in this, let me go through that with me. I'm Brian DeLashman. I represent the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, and the Oregon Nurses Association. And I'm also, I guess, the volunteer or the person that get pushed up in front of you today on behalf of the PERS Coalition, which represents all the public members who have an interest from the employee side on PERS issues. We didn't want to have a whole series of people coming up. So I guess I have a couple of comments. One is related directly to House Bill 2001, but if I may just spend a very brief period of time before that on the initial presentation by PERS about the PERS system, and one of the concerns that seemed to be coming from the chair and other members of the committee was on the issue of the legal advice and the access to legal advice that occurs in executive session. Just to let you know, the PERS Coalition has had that concern for a long period of time. One of the problems we have is being able to figure out why they make the decisions. The PERS Board makes the decisions they make when a lot of the advice is given in executive session, and then what we see in the actual PERS board meetings maybe is more perfunctory and without explanation as far as legal advice. So we have the same concern and have been asking for that information for a long period of time and getting the same answer that the chair got. So it's nice to hear that they're very uniform in their answer.
Have your attorneys given you any advice as to how any other avenue you might pursue legally in order to get access to that testimony?
It is my understanding in over the last number of years that we have requested that information from just about every angle that we could request it, and have been not denied that based upon the client attorney privilege, and have not had access to that information at this point. So we've been attempting to do the same thing. I think the advantage, I understand the dilemma that the PERS Board is in because they are in litigation, and a lot of the discussions, in fact, are how do we deal with litigation, how do we make sure we're not getting into litigation occur behind closed doors. The problem that we have is without knowing the full legal discussions that are going on, then it also puts us in a position of being more litigious and combative because we don't know the full extent of the discussions legally, and I think that actually fosters more litigation rather than trying to get us to a point where we rational minds can figure this out in open public. So I just wanted to offer that comment about the previous presentation. A couple of other items have been mentioned to you. Senate Bill 134 as kind of the precursor to 2001 and 134, it was mentioned to you that that it deals with a couple of issues, but one is it talks about the sufficient size of the gain loss reserve, and then also one of the other elements of that that may not have been mentioned or I missed was the goal in 134 was to make sure that as the last members of Tier 1 are going out the door, you don't have as close to a zero balance in the gain loss reserve as you possibly can. Because the gain loss reserve, if you recall, is only for the purposes of the guarantee on Tier 1. So there, if you go back and turn back the clock prior to stock market going down and all of a sudden we have a deficit, a lot of the discussion at that point was, is the gain loss reserve not only sufficient to get us to the end of all the Tier 1 employees, but is there going to be a large balance? And I wish I could turn back the clock and have that discussion at this point, but is there going to be a sufficient an excess of balance there that somehow we're going to have to figure out how to distribute at the end of the last Tier 1 employee? And the joke at that point was the last employee that goes out on Tier 1 and shuts off a light gets $2 billion, $10 billion, or whatever. Well, obviously, we're in a deficit at this point. So we've got the converse problem to that is to figure out, as we get to the last employee in Tier 1 going out the door, to make sure that at that point, the gain loss reserve is as close to a zero balance as possible. And then we've reached our goal of closing that system down and then focusing on the existing system of Tier 2 and then any other subsequent systems you have in place. So I just wanted to give that a little context. We're going to be spending a lot of time together, obviously, a special committee on PERS, and that was a couple elements that I think were lost in the discussion earlier. Now, directly related to House Bill 2001, the group that came up with Jim Green as the spokesperson before that, representing the employers, indicated that they had a list of recommendations that came before the interim task force. And as a representative of the PERS coalition, I would indicate to you that we have done the same thing during the task force meetings. We have a number of suggestions that we brought forward. We will continue to reinforce those. But House Bill 2001 is one in which I can, and I wish Jim was still here at the table, can happily say that both the employers and the employees have agreed to. And with one caveat, and that is, in fact, the discussion you've had about Section or Lines 22 and 23, the hard cap versus the actual reality that we've got a long period to get ourselves out of the deficit on the gain loss reserve and build up a reserve that's sufficient to get us to that last employee going out. And this language in Lines 22 and 23 is new to us. We think, actually, after listening myself, for me to divorce myself from the coalition, but after listening to the discussion that Mr. Boitko gave you as far as a different kind of a cap, it sounds more of as a rational approach to get to it, that you set a goal and that you don't set the actual hard cap in the statute here of 8%. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
So you'd be more inclined to support what we were calling the effective cap language as long as it
accomplishes
the goal of the actuary redefining his actuarial projection.
To be extremely candid with this committee and not giving away secrets, the PERS coalition, in our discussions, when we get together not only with our attorney, but we've had presentations from the actuarials and other experts, we do not expect that there is going to be in the near or middle future a time in which there is going to be an opportunity to give more than the assumed rate of 8%. Because we believe there'll be a substantial amount of time as you're digging out of the deficit and the gain loss reserve and then building up that that buffer in the gain loss reserve, which was your question, representative Nolan. So in essence, we are saying we surrender, we believe that 8% is about as much as you're going to get, not only in the short term, but the middle term. And we're very cognizant of the problems that the PERS system has. You need to understand that that's a system that our employees rely on. And from, if I may add, from the perspective of whether or not we have concerns about the employers, yes, we have concerns about the cost to employers, because as jobs or people are laid off because the cost of the system goes up, members that all of us represent, in fact, get laid off. So we are attempting to help the system get back on sound footing so that it's a benefit not only to the employees in the retirement phase of the life, but also in the employment phase of their lives.
Does an expedite clause in it give you any pause for thought? Addition to the bill language.
No, it was interesting. You asked the question to Representative Representative Boyko, Mr. Boyko. I'm sure that he's happy he's in the job he's in now. What I was hearing was, has the first board have a policy on expediting things to the Supreme Court? I wasn't aware that the first board had the ability to cut out steps in the judicial process by policy. And it would be my view that the legislature, through statute, has the ability to do that. So you've already done it on the mortality table. As we go through these issues, I think that's a valid question to be asking all the participants. But our position in the first coalition has consistently been is the sooner that we can get to a place where we're out of the mess of litigation, we can get this all resolved, it's better for all parties. And if I may add, it's better if we don't get into litigation in the first place. And so every solution that we bring to you, we've tried to explore the legal parameters of it so that we're not in litigation and then having to figure out whether or not we need to expedite that particular case.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions for Brian Glashman? Anthony?
Chair Knope, members of the committee, my name is Anthony Beda. I represent Lane County Government in front of the Oregon Legislative Assembly. Just a few brief comments to follow up on what's already been said. In terms of Lane County's standing in this manner, we've participated and cooperated with the Association of Oregon Counties and the Employers Task Force that you heard from earlier in terms of developing a list of recommendations. We support those recommendations. Secondly, because I know this issue will come up again and again in the coming months as you look at various proposals dealing with reform of the PERS system, unlike some previous testimony, Lane County has consistently said that we will work to fix and reform the PERS system in order to hold down employer rates on every front that we need to fight it on. That includes in front of this body, it includes the courts, it includes the PERS board, and we have a regular presence there and participate in conveying and communicating our preferences to the board. And it also includes taking advantage of changes in the financial markets that allow us to finance some of our unfunded actuarial liability at favorable rates. And so we're not limited to any one venue to try to get a solution to this. We would like to think that we're going to get a permanent and complete solution to the PERS issue this year in this body. But if that is not the case, we're prepared to push forward in whatever venues are necessary, which has been our behavior for the last 3 or 4 years. Now, to the bill, there really are four issues, I believe, that were raised and that have already been discussed today, and I won't go into them in any detail at all. That includes, of course, on the issue of crediting earnings above the guarantee to member accounts, the issue of creating greater liabilities for the system down the road, the idea that that increase in liabilities creates higher employer rates today, that there is an erosion, therefore, of the ability of the system to fund itself in contingency reserves to cover the bad earnings years. And I think there's a fourth one that wasn't mentioned, and that is that to some degree the awarding of earnings above the 8% to member accounts could be construed as representing a unilateral awarding of benefits to members beyond what is either implied or expressed by the authority of the legislature. So that has to be a point that I think needs continuing review is what is the level of benefits that this legislature has intended or does intend as a result of creating the PERS system in the first place, or if there is a new system ultimately created, what are the level of benefits that you intend to provide?
You mean, Anthony, you mean like a percentage? You mean a defined percentage? Like if we have a defined benefit plan stating that it's there's a cap of 75% of salary, or
there's many different ways to define what the benefit should be, the level of benefit. But in the case of our lawsuit, and in the case of the litigation that we assume is being finalized in front of Judge Lipscomb today, the awarding of interest earnings in the high teens or low 20s in high earnings years to members' accounts creates, again, the upward pressure on rates, creates the greater unfunded liability, right, and of course creates benefits that some people, including the taxpayers of Wayne County that are asking us to fix this, say, don't think were ever intended. Okay. Now, are they exceeding what was intended by 5%, by 25%? Not here to debate that. I'm just saying that's when rubber meets the road. And as a final comment, so that there's clear understanding about where blame or where fix is to lay in this case, it's our thought that clearly those issues are derived from the ambiguity and the ambivalence that exists in statute today about what the legislature intended and how it has directed the PERS system to apply earnings above the guarantee and to award benefit levels. And to the degree that that ambiguity and ambivalence continues to exist, and to the degree that House Bill 2001 fixes that or some other vehicle removes some of that ambiguity, that is something that I think has merit from the position of Wayne County government.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, representatives and members of the committee, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and we are members of a PERS coalition, and to that end, we support Mr. DeLastman's comments to you earlier. I would like to focus my comments on the deletion that hasn't been discussed too much in the testimony so far in lines 14 through 16. We are not clear what if the sentence in line 22 and 23 is modified in some way. We assume that sentence is what drove the deletion in lines 14 through 16. We are concerned that deleting the language in statute that sets the goal of assuring that the gain loss reserve is funded adequately and no more than is adequate to assure the Tier 1 members are benefits are funded appropriately, and no more than that, so that as Mr. DeLashmet spoke to you about, we don't want to see changes in statute today that 25 or 30 years from now cause a fund to exist within the PERS fund that can't be used, and to fund this reserve account beyond what is necessary to deal with the deficit would do exactly that. So we hope that whatever changes are coming forward from Mr. Hendricks to change lines 22 and 23 also take into account whether or not it's appropriate to actually delete that language. And with that, we also support the concept of limiting returns to the assumed rate guarantee. And whether or not you do it as Mr. Wojtko suggested, there's some merit in the idea that a less hard language in the statute may limit the possibility of future suits. We are real happy if that happens. So however that works out, we're okay.
Thank you. Questions? It's my intent to do everything we can to correct the situation, achieve the goal, and minimize the possibility of a legal challenge, because I think everybody's tired of spending time in court and money on attorneys on this particular issue. However, I will ask that, Dave, that when you draft those amendments, that we also draft the inclusion of an expedite just in case someone wishes to sue, and you seem to have something to say, so why don't you come up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sounds like a response.
Chair Knowles, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel, you might want to think a little bit about that.
I will.
And the reason I say that is this. A cap, a hard cap, or even the cap that Mr. Voigtbo has presented, does raise possibilities that at some point in the future, not now obviously, but at some point in the future, the day would come when the deficit is gone, the reserve is fully funded, and member accounts are earning more than 8%. Should that day come, there will be interesting questions about whether what happens to those money and whether this law could stand or could be challenged at that point. And the reason I say that is twofold questions. One is, of course, the contract rights that everybody's talked about. Was there a contract here to receive something beyond the 8%? And the second question also has to do, to some degree, with the operation as the fund of the fund as a trust fund, which it has to be under its tax qualification, as it has always been operated since its instigation, operated as a trust fund for the benefit of the members. Now, we tweaked that language a little bit in 134, but the basic concept there is still that the first emphasis is that it has to operate for the benefit of the member. The member accounts, from the analysis on pension funds at this point, are treated as being basically the member's money. And even though it's paid by the employer on a pickup, an assumption, it's still treated as being the employee's money. And there, the one thing I just want to emphasize is that at some point there could be that issue. It isn't now, because it's our opinion that nobody at this point is harmed by any of these caps. It's hard to argue to go before a court at this point and argue I've been harmed, because it's too hard to tell, it seems to us, whether or not the day will come that in fact we have this remarkable series of events that would have to occur to get the Tier 1. And I should mention, part of the rationale for that is, again, that Tier 1 is a declining member club. There are going to be less and less people with accounts, and we're losing a lot day by day now with retirements as people are getting out, as you can see from the newspaper. There will be less and less people, money there to fund the money you need to get rid of the deficit and to establish the reserve. And you have to have those years in which you earn over 8%. We may not get to that day, which is what I think you were hearing from the representatives from the PERS Coalition in their own discussions. They're thinking they're not going to get there. But if the day did come, you would be looking at that issue. The question is whether you'd want to raise that now by a direct review provision on the constitutionality, or leave it until that day and someday in the future when you might have that scenario come to pass. It's a complicated area. I just think you might want to consider it further before doing an expedited review.
Okay. Jim?
I apologize, Chair Canopa, members of the committee. I couldn't resist weighing in. Our best understanding of HB 2001 would never allow, particularly under sequential crediting, but in general, under either sequential crediting or equal crediting, and we can go into what those are if we need, but the crediting execution that the board does, would never allow monies placed in the gain loss reserve to be used in any other way other than to satisfy the Tier 1 members' need to get their guarantee. So I haven't had the opportunity to talk with David Hendricks about his concerns, so I'd like to do that. But I don't envision 2001, if it were to be enacted into law, to change that. So I don't think there's any question that if monies are placed in the reserve, that they will be used for Tier 1 member accounts only. Second is that I know it's easy to think of the concept of building a reserve like the gain loss reserve, or what we would call the Tier 1 member guarantee reserve, and it builds and builds and builds for that rainy day. But in fact, that doesn't really work that way, because recall that every time we get earnings above 8%, monies may go into that
if it's not at its appropriate level. But also, every time earnings are below 8%, money comes out of it. So in fact, the reserve is resizing itself continuously as it goes along. If the board, for example, finds itself in 2012 with a reserve that's very, very big, that because we've had only good years and very few calls to draw money out of the reserve, finds that the reserve has grown to a point, given the declining balance in Tier 1 members, that it can be resized, the board can simply change its funding policy and go from 30 months to 25 when the Tier 1 population and the monies needing that guarantee, needing that insurance money to meet the guarantee, have declined. So we have looked at this question in some detail and are convinced, particularly given where we're starting from, that the probability of this $2 billion for the last Tier 1 person is extraordinarily remote and can be eliminated by proper board activity to resize the gain reserve to an appropriate size as the Tier 1 population declines. So it's nowhere near, it's not even in the top 50 of my concerns about executing the pension system for the state.
Thank you. Dave, do you have more to add? I knew if we talked long enough, we could find a little disagreement here.
Sheriff Knoll, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks again. The only thing I'd add is I have absolutely nothing. I agree completely with what Jim just said. I mean, he's correct. They will adjust it, and in fact, the policy they're looking at is try to end up with zero balance. So if the reserve gets too big, they will adjust their crediting policies. My point is that in that year when they adjust their crediting policy, we just don't need the money for the reserve anymore. We have enough in there already. We earn 20% this year. What do we do with the money over 8%? At that point, you're looking at the question of the members who are still Tier 1 members and say, well, our money's earned 20%, but we're going to get 8. And then that's when they're going to have, if that scenario comes to pass, that's when you would be looking at the issue of contract rights or perhaps some argument underneath the trust fund aspect of its death. Not so easy, huh?
I hope this is productive for the committee, but again, David is absolutely correct. There will come a time potentially when you have a 20% earnings year, the gain loss reserve is full, and 2001 is effect, and let's say it's the hard cap. The question that David and his colleagues who have JDs on their walls will have to conclude is whether or not the member, the Tier 1 member, has a contract right to a minimum return that's equal to the assumed rate, or a minimum return equal to the assumed rate and excess earnings. And that's
to the extent that there are not other statutory demands for reserves and other things that were in place. That's the issue. And that was the debate we had with Senate Bill 134 last session as it went through the process, and we looked at changing the other reserve. Not just this one, but the contingency reserve, et cetera. The question being, what money is out of the earnings could be put into reserve?
And now you understand why I have forwarded the alternative notion of an effective cap, because if the notion of what the Tier 1 member is guaranteed in the contract is the equal to the assumed rate and the opportunity, subject, as David said, to other policy goals in the statute to participate or to gain access to excess earnings, the question is, what are those alternative competing instances? In the current statute, we have actuarial soundness and we have the gain loss reserve authority. And what 2001 would do if it were put in as a constrained or effective cap would say full actuarial funding is a minimum condition for the Tier 1 members' opportunity to access those excess earnings would be the benchmark, if you will. It gives the Tier 1 member more opportunities than a hard cap, but it conditions them on financial health in the fund as a whole. And this discussion that you've had before you is exactly why we forwarded the idea of effective or prerequisite kind of cap.
Dave, so just so I'm clear, as it relates to your suggestion that maybe we don't put an expedite clause to the Supreme Court in this, are you saying that putting that there might flag for the court that we thought that there might be a constitutional issue with what we're doing?
No, Chairman, no. Actually, the thought would be that you would not probably want to say to get an immediate decision. If in fact there is a problem, that problem could wait till another day until you actually had someone who could say they were harmed by reason of this change. You would have to get to the day when the harm occurred, and it may never come.
Okay.
And
so you just don't believe it's really necessary for this particular bill?
That is correct.
Chairman?
Wow, we got an opinion out of you.
That's
what I was looking for. Representative Richardson.
Chairman Knopen, Dave, aren't you talking about a rightness issue? Because if there's going to be a lawsuit, there's going to be a lawsuit. And so without the expediting clause, it's going to go through circuit court, appellate court, and make its way to the Supreme Court. Why not have it go to the Supreme Court, and then if they think it's not ripe to be determined, they would say so now instead of having to wait a year to get there.
Representative Richardson, you're correct. It's just that so often the way we have written those expedited clauses have been basically to create ripeness. Now, to basically say, we want you to decide it now. It would be nice to know, but in this case, it may not be so nice to know so quick about this particular one. Because if it never comes to pass that this is a problem, because we never get to that year that we've discussed way down the line, there will be no need to have a decision.
I understand that. As a follow-up, what I'm saying is if there's a lawsuit, the lawsuit's going to get filed. Do we want it filed in the circuit court and have to wait until it gets to the Supreme Court because it's going to get appealed all the way up there anyway, or have the Supreme Court go ahead and make the determination now? I mean, why wait a year to 3 years on a lawsuit that's going to probably happen instead of getting a determination now? We're not saying we want a final determination. We're just wanting a final decision on any lawsuit that is immediately filed or filed in the interim relating to this issue.
Representative Richardson, I don't think it would harm as long as we made it very clear that we weren't foreclosing the ripeness issue.
Certainly.
I think the courts are very sensitive about direct review provisions anyway. And in fact, at some point they may be over here complaining about too many bills with direct review to the Supreme Court. But they are sensitive, and what they always will talk to you about is they'll come in and they'll start talking to you about, if they're kind, they'll talk about case and controversy. If not, they'll talk about justiciability, both of which are fairly complicated concepts, but the idea being that we just don't have a real dispute here that we resolve. Our Supreme Court has said on many occasions and will continue to say they don't render advisory opinions. In other words, they have to have two opposed parties standing out there in front of them, as you know, with opposing interests, and if it's not right, that's part of that. That's part of that. If it's just not ready for decision, they'll probably decide that. So it would be okay, I think, if we could craft it carefully and make sure we weren't somehow suggesting we really want a decision on this now, even though it may not be the time.
Did you have a follow-up? Dave, is there any middle ground here? And I say that only because the reason I even bring it up in the first place is because my fear would be that, you know, we pass bills, they get signed into law, and we leave session on May 31st. June 1st. I don't know. Anyway, whatever the date happens to be, I guess. And somebody decides that they just don't like anything we did. And they decide they're going to go down and file a lawsuit on every PERS bill that there was because they just feel that somehow they've been violated. And therefore, the litigation process starts and, you know, it turns on and we have to wait for that to work it through Circuit Court, Court of Appeals, and we're not in session for another 18 months. We cross our fingers and hope that that's true once we left the building. So my question is it possible to put that on there and sunset it so it sunsets when the new, like at the date that a new session would start, so we would actually be in session, and if that case had occurred and the legal process had actually taken place and worked itself to a point where it either worked itself to the Supreme Court or, let's say, it didn't, and we get into session again and it looks like there doesn't seem to be any interest in lawsuits on this particular issue, then it would just go away once we started a new legislative session, and we would be there anyway to pass that type of legislation if we needed to.
Chair, no, you of course can do a limited duration automatic appeal. In fact, we've done those before, saying you have to file them within a certain period of time after the effective date of the act. I would just mention that in the past, the automatic review provisions to the Supreme Court, one of the principal reasons they've been put on bills was the fear that someone would file a case and seek a stay of the legislative action pending the final decision by the court. And because the legislature wanted to move ahead, what they wanted to do is say, well, we anticipate there's going to be a stay. Let's get it decided quick so that if we win, the stay goes away. I don't think you're looking at that scenario here, because one of the things you have to show in order to get a stay is irreparable harm of some sort if you don't get the stay. In this case, as I say, it's going to be hard for anybody to show that, because under the existing law, for the immediate and medium future anyway, nobody is going to have anything less than what they would have had anyway.
Chair Canope, in the interest of the system, I have to say that the advice that David gave you, and I have no reason to doubt it, but from our perspective, from administering the system, we need to be sure that it's as close to 100% certain as possible for the following reason. If David is correct, and nobody can really challenge the hard or the effective cap until the time that we have eliminated the deficit, the tier one deficit, not the UAL, but the tier one deficit, and built up the reserves until they have met whatever board the goal sets, and then we encounter a year in which we have excess earnings, which, based on our simulation, you know, it could be sooner, but we would expect it to be a decade away. If that's the case, then expedited review is not so important. However, if somebody can challenge the constitutionality of this bill, absent showing harm, just that it is is unconstitutional on its face, and I'm way beyond my expertise, but if they can, then we risk, and we don't have expedited review, we risk doing lots of earnings creditings before we find out that 2001 is not acceptable to the courts. And it would put us in exactly the same position as a pension system that we have with Judge Lipscomb's ruling, which is requiring us to go back to 1999 and change all those crediting decisions. And as you know, we have a compounding system. It means all the ones in 2000, 2001, 2002 all change. So I'm not doubting David's view, but what rests on its accuracy is this whole notion of a massive legacy work project sometime in the future if we're wrong.
And my only response to that, Chernoff, would be you wouldn't be going back over 10 years of crediting decision. You're only going back over years similar to the one in which you've just described. So assuming someone came in the first year in which you had that scenario, you would only be looking at that year as far as the change.
Well, that's not...
And at that point, it's quite possible to come back and look at this again legislatively.
I rarely find myself disagreeing with my learned colleague. However, from experience with Judge Lipscomb's decision, I can tell you that the set of transactions we would have to undo would be those that would date from the time we made accrediting under those circumstances that I just described, and the time that the court either ruled one, potentially ruled against it. And that is where expedited decision-making would become possible. I'm not arguing for it or against it. I'm just saying that based on David's assessment of when the issue could be brought, it makes a huge difference to us operationally about what the consequences of court rejection of 2001 would be.
Right. I'm just going to call this a draw. Thank you, gentlemen. Well, Dave, I think I'm going to ask you to do the amendments closer to what I think would be termed the effective cap. See if we can work on language with Jim and others. Try to make that so we can avoid to the greatest degree possible the possibility of litigation.
And I'd also note that in response to Smith's testimony that she is correct with the way Jim is going, the language that currently is bracketed out at line 13 to 16 sets the goal for the reserve should be reinstated.
Okay. So everybody's aware, and as soon as the amendments are done, and I guess the jury's still out on the expedite issue, but if you have thoughts on it, please feel free to contact me. But let's not all run down and draft our own expedite language. Let's just have one if we're going to do it, because I think we can probably agree that it either needs to happen or it doesn't. But I don't think we want them to draft four or five versions of it. So thank you. And if there's no one else to testify on the bill, which it appeared that there wasn't, and I see no one rushing to the podium, committee is adjourned.